Welcome to the $64,000 question.
Does Office Space
push pencils? I don't know.
This is going well. This is going well right out the gate.
So let's start over. I'm serious. Let's start over. Okay. Welcome to the 64th episode of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck? Where we revisit great movies from the 80s and 90s that actually might suck. And today's episode is Office Space.
My name is Travis Sintel.
Wait a minute. Nope. All right, let's start over. We're pretty tired still, guys. You know, we just recorded...
Travis Sintel.
We just recorded our last episode, our previous episode last night. It was a late night.
I just spilled beer on my pants.
And then today we had another day of shooting, so that's where we're at as you listen to this. We're still here in Chicago, and now we're fucking exhausted. We just smoked these big cigars, some celebration cigars, and then thinking this is all right. We're putting a nice cap on the evening. It's time to go to bed. Let's smoke these celebration cigars on an experience well lived. And then we were like, oh, fuck, we got to record that intro.
We got to go talk about Office Space. It is weird. I will say, it is weird. Like, this is an exciting time
for us. Let me define the word got to. Because this is all, this is all self-appointed. Like, we're just deciding.
That's what I was about to say. We're in the middle of this pretty fun, awesome, amazing experience for us. Something we've been trying to do for a long time and looking forward to doing. And then we had to come back to this nice hotel and record The Sandlot.
Yeah, it took a lot out of us.
It was a weird thing. It
took a sand lot out of us. And now we're on to Office Space, which, I don't want to be unfair to Office Space. Like,
Office
let's just
Space
be,
rules.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Very excited that this movie came up. Mike Judge, we've already talked about Beavis and Butthead Do America, which was not very good. I mean, it was fine, but it was not very good, ultimately. It was kind of a
disappointment. Is it weird that I don't blame him? Should I blame him more? Because maybe on the podcast we did, but as memory has gone on from that episode, which was about a year ago now, or more than a year.
Well, it's hard to blame someone for a first movie that just doesn't quite work.
Yeah, it doesn't work as a film. Especially when you know
that their next movie and subsequent films and projects are incredible. Like, what's amazing is, and maybe we probably touched a lot about this on Beavis and Butthead, I can't remember, is just the way that Mike Judge has stayed present. I wouldn't have guessed that.
I agree with that. I really agree with that.
And that's amazing. And he evolved and changed, or, you know, he just had these particular kinds of, you know, depths or alternate sides to him, and that, you know, that turned into a different career than the guy who created Beavis and Butthead, Frog Baseball, you know, like, he's not that guy, it turns out.
Exclusively.
There are a couple times.
So this podcast for me has been a real roller coaster. And there's sometimes I show up to do the podcast and I think, fuck, man, I got to do this thing and I got to watch this dumb movie I don't really want to watch. And there's other times I show up and I think, oh, I'm so happy I'm doing this podcast because it gives me a reason to watch a movie again that I've wanted to rewatch for a very long time. Office Space is the latter, for sure. I have wanted to rewatch this for quite some time, ever since Mike Judge really fucking came back so hard with all these different films. Idiocracy, Into Silicon Valley, all this stuff. Like, he's...
Well, particularly Silicon Valley. Yeah. I mean, and that obviously, you know, the ones that we're going to have to talk about most. I don't know. Have you seen Extract? Did you see that movie? Mm-mm. It's really funny, and it's totally underrated, and it's super funny.
Is that Jason Bateman?
Yeah. But it's kind of, in a funny way, it's kind of this, like, the sister film to this, because... You know, in that movie, Ben Affleck basically plays the Diedrich Bader part, and it's got the same kind of central hero. It's really good and underrated. But that movie and Silicon Valley surely are the closest to Office Space in terms of the Mike Judge movies. And Idiocracy is kind of closer to the Beavis and Butthead side, although its own crazy animal for sure. Anyway, I'm rambling. The point is, I love this guy. I think I love this movie, but I have not seen it for a very, very long time. And like many, I was very late to the Office Space game, you know?
Yeah.
I saw it on video.
What year is this?
I want to
say 96.
8, 99?
Okay.
I think it's late.
I wanted to say 99 initially because of the reaction to corporate life sort of undertone in this film, which is 97, 98, 99. There's a lot of movies dealing with that idea around that time.
Right.
Also, side story, the guy who does the O face used to come into the restaurant I worked at, and he'd put on like 90,000 pounds and was much heavier. But he always people always used to recognize him and go, do the O face, and I just felt bad for
him. Did he do it?
Yeah, of course.
No way.
Yeah.
Every time?
Yeah. I mean, the ones I saw. And also Carlton Banks from, well, Alfonso Ribeiro. Carlton Banks from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Now host of America's Funniest Videos.
Yep. He used to come
to
the restaurant.
Isn't that weird? America's, I think it's called America's Funniest Videos now. Yeah. Home videos is not a thing.
That is weird. I mean,
it's all
sense.
Cell phone videos. Yeah, yeah, the whole show is cell phone videos.
Of course it is.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. I mean, I get it.
It doesn't fit. It just doesn't fit.
No, things.
It's a bad show now, guys. Changes. Don't watch
now,
it.
Now it's a bad show.
It was great.
Yeah.
Once upon a time.
Sure. but he would come in the restaurant and everyone would say, do the Carlton dance. And this look of just deep sadness would come over his face. And he would do it like half-assed. He would do it. I'm not joking. He would fucking do it almost every time.
Wow.
And it was sad.
It's already sad. It's sad in a lot of ways.
Sorry, back to Office Space.
So, you know, I don't have a lot to say except that I really want to like it.
I have a question.
Well, I have one thing that I just remembered, which is that when JC, our guest from last episode, was leaving, he said, oh, I'm so excited you guys are doing that. I'm so jealous.
Yeah.
And he immediately, it's so funny that he's your friend because you're the only person that I know that would make this connection, but is totally right. And then I heard him do it and I was like, oh, yeah. Where he's like, this came out in that flush of Fight Club.
I was about to make that exact connection.
Yeah. That's crazy to think of.
That's why I was going to say 99 and then I second guessed myself.
It is 99, yeah.
Yeah, so no, I made that exact same connection.
Which is Fight Club year.
Yeah. Which is this reaction against corporate America, and there's a corporatization of masculinity, I guess.
Right.
And I think that's part of what this was. Just Mike Judge has a very different take on it than Chuck Palahniuk, obviously.
Do you think that on that level, does Office Space last better than Fight Club? And if so, why? Maybe we'll just find out when we watch the film, but.
I have a lot to say about this. I feel like, again, and we'll deal with this when we get to Fight Club. I think Fight Club's pretty misunderstood in the popular culture because of the people that latched onto it. And I think that the office space subversion, the subversive humor in it, is more broadly accepted because the people who latch onto it don't have to get it all the way to still be in the ballpark. Where I think that some of the other films, they're in the wrong ballpark. So this one, I think you can get it on multiple levels depending on how willing you are to engage with the material. And I think, you know, comedy has a better sort of track record for this sort of material than transgressive, aggressive, you know, dark fiction.
Well, he's just, I mean, when I think about Mike Judge, though, he's, I guess what you're kind of saying is that this is more easy to tap into on the sort of surface levels.
Yes, that's a better way of saying that.
But, which is probably true, but it's the mark of genius that it also runs so fucking deep. Like, the movie is about the same, it's the same subject as Fight Club. It's coiled male rage. It's repressed male rage being sort of boxed and bottled into a thing. And they're both satirical.
Absolutely. And using cubicle domestic life as a way into that. They seem to go about it the same way, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, I can't, there's, it's funny because I remember little things from Office Space.
This is the question I was going to ask you. What are the things that you remember specifically?
Well, I remember Stephen Root. I remember the Milton character.
Do you want to do an impression of it?
Stapler, you know, like, I guess I can do it.
I'm so happy I asked you to do that.
Pretty much got
he,
it.
He's, pretty guys, much got listeners, it. He kind of shrugged his shoulders and did a toss off from Stapler.
Yeah.
Great. O-Face, obviously, everyone remembers.
Sure.
I would argue that the intro, pretty much everyone remembers, right?
Don't remember.
It's not the intro, but him driving to work, Michael Bolton is driving to work and listening to rap music, and when he pulls up alongside African-American guys, he turns the music down.
Oh, I didn't really remember that, but sure.
Yeah,
that's what I remember. I remember Gary Cole.
He rules.
And I remember that, like, I remember things that are in it. Like, I remember that awesome scene where they go out and they destroy a copy machine or whatever, fax or whatever it is. And
I remember a lot about this.
And, well, now that I'm really sitting here thinking about it, I also remember that they do the Superman 3. It's about a crime ripoff. They're going to rip off the company by stealing the sort of half cents or whatever. Yeah.
God, yeah. I'm shocked how much of this movie I actually remember.
But yeah, but all of that said, I mean, you know, it's funny that that's how, what I'm remembering now is like, I was going to say, I really was going to say, I remember little moments, but I don't remember the story. I do remember the story.
Same. And
it took me about a second to really check in.
I didn't think I did until we started talking about it. It's been about 15 years, by the way, since I've seen this
movie.
Me
too. Me too. I haven't seen this, I would guess since college and then maybe once. I mean, I've seen it maybe 2-3 times in my entire life. But what's cool about that is that the thing that dazzles me most about Mike Judge now, specifically Silicon Valley, is that Silicon Valley, and some of my comedy friends talk about this, Joey Devine, Sean has talked about this, and Sean Keane thinks that, but mostly Joey Devine, is that it's the rare comedy which is obsessively devoted to story. It is story.
That's
story.
That's a great point. That's a great point, actually.
It's really interesting because Silicon Valley cranks through plot.
Yeah.
It continues to be hysterical on a character level. But
man, if you think about that for a second, it's a really deep point. It feels like a sort of surface level point, but there's something really in that, I think.
Yeah, and this movie has a fucking story. Like, I remember now. I'm remembering how much story is in it. And that, I think that's true. That's true about Extract. That's in some ways, I guess it's not really true about Idiocracy. That's probably more of a skit thing.
It's so easy for an office comedy to just be forgettable and dumb. It's so simple. The format of this shouldn't be memorable. It's not an especially creative format. And the millions of TV shows and movies and sketches have addressed this concept and failed to last or to hit the nail.
That's, you know, this is not the American Office.
Yes.
It's a very different thing that he can do. And his style of comedy is extremely different. It's not sketchy. It's funny. It's not.
It's not. It's Mike Judge.
And even the best of Beavis and Butthead, in a certain way, he really took seriously the idea of a sitcom story. Like, they're going to have a thing. It's going to be tiny. You know, you often make the sort of, these guys have to go up the steps or down the steps or whatever, and then that's the thing. But, like, he really clings to the skeleton of a story. Something starts, that makes something happen, then it's over. You know, like, I think that's how he works his films or his narratives, his comedy.
What is it? How is he able to do that? Why can no one else do that?
It's really hard.
That's the thing they seem so simplistic. And I don't think anyone who watched, and I certainly watched Office Space, I was unaware of the levers and wheels and gadgets and gears going on beneath the surface to make that thing click along like it does. But now that I have some distance on it, I'm expecting
experience. I'm really eager to watch it on those levels and to see how it works. Because the thing that defines Mike Judge as an artist to me is the deceptiveness. Deceptive simplicity. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like it's his
that's
work.
What
seems
I was saying.
So
yeah, yeah. It seems
dumb and
so banal
broad and obvious,
and just yeah, and just straight through the.
And it's just because but he's so direct. He's just so.
Did you watch much King of the Hill?
Only a little.
Same. What was up with that?
Don't know. I mean, yeah. I think my guess about King of the Hill is that he created it, sure, and he did the voice, but I don't think he was day-to-day creative on that. I don't know that for a fact. I may just be like deciding that that's true, but something I think that I remember that somehow is
what
that
is this podcast about except for us pretending to remember stuff.
I mean, why, you know, what else are you listening for?
That's what we do.
Anyway, I don't know, so I'm looking forward to it. I think this is an awesome, funny cast, although interestingly a cast that did not really go that far
big time.
O-face
guy didn't look healthy.
I mean, the most famous person from here is probably Stephen Root in a funny way.
That is weird.
I mean, yeah, because you got Diedrich Bader, you got Ron Livingston.
Ron Livingston went on to a couple things. I can't name them, but I feel like he's been through some things. I see his face around sometimes. I go, oh, that guy.
You got that David, what's his name? David Heyman, who was from Mad TV or something, whatever his name is. But he's very funny in this. Anyway, it's going to be amazing.
I think it's going to be really fun. I'm excited to do it. We're going to be back after we watch Office Space, and I expect that we'll have some glowing things to say.
How about if you do it? Did you already do it? Did you already do your Milton? Say a different word, like another thing he says.
it's not what
it's Like, I'm so glad that you're just subjecting yourself to this.
Hold on, I'm not done.
You can't imagine how much I hate this, but I feel
I know,
like...
I that's why I want to keep going. And the only person I think that hates it more than you is every other listener. All right, we'll be back.
Would you walk us through a typical day for you?
Yeah.
Great.
Well, I generally come in at least 15 minutes late. I use the side door. That way Lumberg can't see me. And after that, I just sort of space out for about an hour.
Space out?
Yeah, I just stare at my desk, but it looks like I'm working. I do that for probably another hour after lunch too. I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Peter, would you be a good sport and indulge us and just tell us a little more?
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you something about TPS reports.
All right, we watched it. Just going to say it right now. We're cutting forward a full week from when we last recorded, and that has been a long week. I don't remember what we said in the intro at all. Like, not even a little bit.
Yeah. I'm going to need you to go back a week. I don't remember either. I did, full disclosure, I watched it about 5 days ago now.
Watched it last night.
And I think that's actually helpful, because this is a movie I think that sits differently with a little space, no pun intended. I think it sits with you in the things that percolate. It wasn't a box office hit, I think, because it took time to.
So you're theorizing that in your 5 days of time, it's really like. It's really settled, and you have a different point of view than I might have from last night.
Well, I've gotten somewhere else.
Okay.
I think.
Okay.
And it's interesting to me.
So
it's
you
not
evolved
necessarily...
into a new idea? Or a
well,
new
no, I don't think
thoughts.
I necessarily evolved it, but it's sat in a part of my brain I didn't expect it to.
Okay.
And had I recorded this 5 days ago, I think I would have talked about other things.
Well, this is going to be great. We have two totally, wildly different takes on this. Because I am so fresh on it, man. I watched it late last night.
You know it. I don't know it that well anymore. I don't know
man.
It. I just have senses about it.
I don't know. Well, you know what, though? That's a funny thing, because it's not a movie. There are things to know, but there's not much in it. Like, that's what's so funny is it's 89 minutes long, and it doesn't have. I'll start by saying this: it doesn't have one consistent plot. Mm-mm. It has about three, and they very casually blend into one another.
Yeah.
And so you're never. It's a movie that works better after you've seen it at least once, because you know it's not, none of these things are going to turn into the thing. I mean, like, Mike Judge is amazing, because it's sort of what I thought while I was watching the movie is this is a little bit like anarchic in its slackness.
Yeah. Well, the tone meets the content. Like, it's really fun. The idea of the film.
Totally.
Meets
but like
what it's doing.
You're watching this movie and it's kind of going along, and it's very funny and sharp and broad, and the characters are cool and interesting. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. It's visually it's flat, which also is interesting. And but then, you know, I'm going to say 25 minutes in, it sets you up with the premise, which is that this guy goes to a hypnotist, and that in the middle of hypnosis of being putting him into a relaxed headspace, the hypnotist dies, so he's stuck feeling relaxed.
Yeah,
that. Triggers the plot,
I mean,
but then eventually
sort of.
He's like, I don't know, I guess it's going away, because he starts to get riled up again.
Sort of. That's the thing. Also, a therapist played by Mike McShay is one of my favorite improvisers. That guy is awesome.
He's great.
So there's a lot of weird cameos in the Orlando Jones is a cameo in the film also and stuff. But it's a series of sketches and ideas.
But it's different from that. I mean, I'm not saying that's wrong, but it's like they're very long sketch ideas. Like, there's about three short films in here, and that's how it feels.
Three short films is much better than sketches.
Yeah.
That's better. That's what it is. But it feels though there's scenes that are drawn out and there's sketch ideas in them. But that's right. It's three short films, kind of like meandering into each other.
Yeah,
and it's this idea of. I mean, Kalen's done the plot. Like, that he really has kind of hit it.
Because then there's two other plots.
But those are small. So the film, as I understand it, was based on this short cartoon thing he did for SNL and other places called about Milton, right?
I think it was just for, like, Spike and Mike. I don't think it was SNL.
I think it aired
Maybe
there.
It was SNL. They put Milton on SNL.
I think that's my first exposure to it.
That
Maybe
is very
wrong,
bizarre.
But I think
Okay, I believe it.
And he gets a chance to do a feature-length film. I guess someone said, hey, do you want to make this into a feature?
And
he
made notes in a Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah,
I made it into a side character. They're like, what would you want to do as a movie? And yeah. He said, I would like to turn this into a film.
Yeah, and then set of sidebars. One of the plots, I guess, is Milton
sort of.
trying to get recognized or to get heard, and he ends up, whatever. Like, here's the plot. Ron Livingston plays this guy who, Kalen says, is very unhappy with his job. He's a cubicle worker. He's got two friends, Michael Bolton and a guy whose last name
Samir
I can't pronounce.
Nayinanajad.
There you go.
Nayinanajad. What's so hard about that?
There you go. And
although that not gonna work here anymore is so funny. That line is so funny to me.
Is that John C. McGinley's line?
The other guy.
Yeah. They're all sad about their lives, and they have a shitty boss, and it's just like kind of, you know, send up of office cubicle lifestyle. And they bring in a guy who's going to downsize the company, and he's going to interview everyone to see if, you know, are you worth your job. And there's gags around there that Milton, the guy, Man in the High Castle.
The great Stephen Root.
Yeah, the Man in the High Castle is told. We find out that he got fired a year and a half ago, but no one told him. And the payroll, there's been a payroll glitch where he's still getting paid, which is a funny idea.
It's all funny.
And they decide not to tell him. They just decide to like stop paying him and see if he notices and goes away. Is the idea. So one of the plots is Ron Livingston goes to this therapist and he gets stuck in this super chill thing and finds out that he just tells everybody the way it is. He just like, I hate this job and I only work 4 hours a week, really. But this transparency.
He does 15 minutes a week.
Yeah, 15 minutes a week.
I do 15 minutes of actual work
a
week.
And so this this transparency and honesty that peg him pretty much as upper management. I mean, that's really.
Well, but I mean, and it's so brilliant because it gets just like Silicon Valley. It's sort of a cool time capsule because it gets everything right about the internet sort of drone boom of the late 90s and early 2000s, which is that who he says that to are two consultants who have been brought in to downsize the company or to evaluate the company. And so it's them who he's appealing to. And my favorite part about that whole plot is when they're presenting who should get fired and who should get promoted to Gary Cole. And their interaction with him, I don't know why I found it so funny.
I thought it was awesome.
But
too.
When John McGinley is getting so angry that Gary Cole is not like getting why Ron Livingston should be promoted is so hilarious.
Yeah.
And they like have to speak for one another. Anyway, but it's all very specific to a certain kind of corporate culture.
Yeah. Also, the rough idea, which I think we can come back to, that the incentives are totally in the wrong place for these corporate environments. Is funny. Anyway, so Ron Livingston meets a girl, a waitress next door, played by Jennifer Aniston, and she also hates her job because what you guys remember. That's that sort of romance subplot has a thing. And then they concoct halfway through the film this idea that they're going to rob the company by taking microtransactions and funneling them out. And which is barely even a real thing, and they even recognize in the movie. They go, "Yeah, you heard this in Superman 3.
We
just stole this from Superman 3. They just acknowledge it straight up, and it kind of goes somewhere. They end up taking too much money and try to return it. It's all very slapdash and haphazard and sort of lazy in a way that I think is awesome and funny.
Yes.
And then Milton ends up burning the building down because they put him in the basement. And
which basically solves all
which
their
absolves
problems.
All the issues because I guess the financial transaction record is burnt in the fire.
Yeah.
And Ron Livingston ends up working at a construction company at the end, very happy. Like the third act is nutso.
I mean, they just don't bother to solve any story. Yeah. They just end the movie basically. Yeah. It's amazing. It's so funny and so great. And like it is I thought a lot of things watching the movie. On the most macro level, I was like, well, of course this wasn't a hit. Like, obviously, like, this is so, like, anti-theatrical in a funny way, where it lives on perfectly as something that you revisit, and you start to sort of appreciate really tiny things. And just this sort of, like, I watched it, it's so weird, I started watching it at 11:30 last night, and, you know, it's been a long week, it's been a long month, we've been working really hard, and I thought, okay, I'll probably get a half hour through this, I'll finish it tomorrow. And I watched the whole thing, and there was something that occurred to me about, like, this is the kind of movie that lives best late at night when like the stakes are low for like laughing or something. Like I don't know why, but it's not
comfortable.
Yeah, it's so comfortable. Yeah, and it's not I was not bored. I was not gonna fall asleep. I was totally into the experience of it.
Yeah.
But I wasn't like exploding with laughter or anything. And so it's such a low key but perfectly observed thing that it's like I don't know. It where it lives now is the best place for it.
It could go so wrong. The idea of putting big characters in a flat corporate environment is a pretty dangerous idea for a lot of people, I think.
Well, but you know what's amazing? That's the other thing I was going to say about the movie, actually, this is funny, is the three main characters are not really caricatures. They kind of are, but they kind of aren't. And there are big joke people around them who are, you know, what's the word? Stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
All funny and all, again, all smartly targeted. But what I thought most about the film is that this is a, unlike so many movies we've watched, let's say for this show or from the 80s, especially like, let's say first feature films from like Fast Times at Ridgemont High to, you know, Dazed and Confused or whatever. They have these casts that will, it's weird to watch it now because they all went on to these great, great things.
Mm-hmm.
Office Space's cast did not.
Did you Google any of the guys? Because well, I remember thinking, like,
what's
what
funny is
to
I know
Michael
them
Bolton?
All. What's funny is I know, well, that's David Herman, who I knew, who I was, I actually, weirdly, when I saw this when I was a kid, he was the one that I knew most because I was interested in the idea of an original cast for Mad TV. And it was, and so I watched that first season, not even because I liked Mad TV that much, but because I was like, this is cool. They're trying to start a new thing. And it's a big deal that these are the people they picked for this new sketch show. And so like him and Artie Lang and the other people who were on that first season, I still think of with some sort of warm familiarity. And he was really funny on it. And he's so amazingly, amazingly good in this. But it's so fucking Office Space that they didn't go on to any bigger notoriety or bigger career.
Yeah.
Even Ron Livingston, who's good in it. He's so good.
Everyone's great.
Yeah, everyone's great. And the only places they went were like other kind of TV roles. Even Gary Cole, who's obviously fucking amazing, you find him on Silicon Valley now. And, you know, there was another... John C. McGinley, it didn't become a huge star. And all of that said, the only person who sticks out as like, what are you doing here, is Jennifer Aniston.
Yeah. I've had two Jennifer Aniston encounters in the last 2 weeks. My sister wanted to watch The Switch, which I'd never seen. I don't want to get a Jennifer Aniston wormhole. It's just, she's always fine. She's like, shows up, I think, and that's cool. But
let's not travel down. People might want to hear us talk about this. I don't know. But like, it was like, oh yeah, Friends. That's what I thought watching this.
Oh,
was
same.
Like, oh yeah, Friends.
In fact, just to confirm, while I was watching it, I just looked up. I was like, "We're in the middle of Friends, right?" And I looked, and
I would love to know how it happened that they got Jennifer Aniston in this movie, because as a leap from TV to film, I get it. The Mike Judge is making a movie; he's a big deal. It's his leap, certainly, from cartoons or animation to live action, and from television to film. Okay, this all kind of makes sense. But it's so... I just... Like, did she like it? If she loved the script, I kind of have a lot of respect for her, even though I don't think she fits in this world. But I almost am worried that it's, like, an agent thing, where it's like, this would be good for you. And it wasn't. It's a bad call. No, like, she shouldn't be in this movie. There should be somebody else.
That being said, the other waiter at her restaurant should be in
the movie. That guy's amazing.
Awesome.
Guy is amazing.
He was my favorite, like, obsession of the film. Every time he came on camera, I was super into him.
He's so horrible and abrasive.
Yeah, it's great.
And Mike Judge, who plays her boss, is insanely funny.
Yeah.
And, like, it makes me wish that Mike Judge were in all of his shit. But
yeah,
he rarely is. Because he's so funny in that scene.
I got kind of obsessed. So, you know, we left on this. This is the part of the intro I think we did hit on, which was this: the relation of this film to Trainspotting and to Fight Club and this anti-corporate culture idea. This idea that you are not your things, that you are not the money that you make. And I kind of, this is what I've been thinking a lot about this week, is... So just to set the stage, in 99, we're coming to the end of Bill Clinton's presidency. You have the rise of extraordinarily partisan politics. This is kind of where it starts to really take traction. Mm. Bill Clinton's impeachment, you're starting to see a really big schism between the left and the right. It's always been there. But this is, you know, if you think about Nixon, you know, he was impeached with a 90% something, you know, vote. Like, that was not a partisan thing. Imagine Trump getting impeached. That vote's not going to be 90% regardless, right? We're in a different era now. And I think it's fair to say the mid-90s when these films are developing and becoming things and the books are being written that they're based on, not Office Space, but this idea of, you know, Dilbert is coming, you know, is really hitting its stride around this time. Mm-hmm. And the idea that there's two approaches to this. One is satire of corporate drone culture, like this cubicle culture. And the other is the how do you find who you are? How do you find your humanity in this, which is Fight Club or Trainspotting on these mm-hmm. things, right? And so the idea that you are not defined by the money you make, you're not defined by what you do, this is the era for this. And the idea that we're starting to see the cracks in capitalism here, I think leads to where we are today, because people are looking for meaning wherever they can. They were told through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and the 80s, especially under Reagan, that if you do your job and you show up, you can find meaning in your work. It's not just drudgery. You belong to a company. Your identity is wrapped up in what you do. You can become someone who is worth something to your family and to the world by doing things. And then in the 90s, that proves to be a lie. That proves to be a big lie, right, which Office Space addresses, which Fight Club addresses.
Yes. Go ahead.
So,
I'm going to push back a little bit.
Yeah, I want you to. I want to talk about this. So, I feel here in this late 90s sensibility the rumblings of a dissatisfaction with the way America has turned out. And it starts to go in two separate ideological directions. And you have the Bernie Sanders socialist direction that we should do more. We should give meaning. We should provide social safety nets so that we can pursue meaning. And the other side is you have to carve your own meaning, and there is something to be salvaged from this capitalist ideology. And we didn't do it right because we didn't structure it right. We put too much social safety nets in place. We're not incentivizing people the right way. Fight Club, Trainspotting, and Office Space all talk about the incentives being in the wrong place. That's interesting.
Explain that to me just in the context of Office Space. Are you talking? How does this movie speak to incentives?
Well, very directly, I would say, in that Ron Livingston. The chaos of this idea is that when he tries to do his job and be good, he doesn't raise up in the ranks. When he says, fuck it, this is obviously ridiculous, you guys, they want to promote him. That is incentivizing the wrong way. The movie points to it and says, you're doing the wrong thing by chasing the dollar. You're doing the wrong thing by doing what your boss tells you. Fight Club says the same thing in a way. It's when you speak up and say the truth that everyone knows but is afraid to say, oh, that's striking to people. People are confused by that. And the movie makes comedy out of it, which is the outsiders want to promote him. The insiders want to demote him for it.
Yeah, I guess so. I think that the movie is not making much of a social commentary about that.
I completely agree. Because I think that's happenstance that happens.
Yeah, I think that's just that's a familiar feeling, a familiar gag, and a sort of funny result to what happens when you sign up and try to, you know, just fall in line and play your part. I mean, to say that you should step outside of that and sort of question things is inherent to the story. But what I find interesting about the film is that this is going to sound really weird, and I don't know if you're going to buy it. I'm just going to talk it through. Mike Judge seems somehow past the bullshit of those conversations because his characters don't want greatness. They certainly don't want a flashy life. They just want to a better life and just to be sort of content. I mean, Ron Livingston is very clear with his articulation of his goals, which is to do nothing. He wants not to work. And that's a petty ambition. And it's not even one that Mike Judge is venerating, and it's not one he gets. But it's the idea that, you know, this isn't somebody who's angry like Michael Bolton might be, I guess, who's angry at the world for not giving him his share or for telling him that the wrong set of rules. He just thinks it sucks. And so that in this really weird way, like Mike Judge's sort of, it feels like he already knows that this is the state of the world. Like nothing is surprising to him.
Let me clarify that, because what I mean is not from a creative construction standpoint. I'm not talking about Chuck Palahniuk, Irving Welsh, or Mike Judge or David Fincher. I'm talking about the reason these stuck around in the popular culture, these three projects, I think, is that partly people who want to feel transgressive but aren't. These are movies, all three of those movies are quoted by people in fraternities, just to make a broad brush idea here. You see these posters still up around. And I think this idea of social transgressiveness without actually being transgressive is appealing.
But Office Space is, they're so meek and minimal. Their rebellion, they make huge fun of their rebellion by shooting, like, the one of the funniest sequences is their heist maneuver, which is shot in this hilarious, super funny way with this hip hop music under it. And then, but it's like they're just passing a disc to their partner, and then they hand it to another guy, and then he puts it in another computer, and it's like, and then he comes back, and Ron Livingston's like, "Well, that was easy," and they're like, "Oh yeah, I guess it was." Like, but there's their rebellion, which he may be tapping into the same things. I mean, I don't think that this movie is making fun of Fight Club or anything like that. It couldn't possibly be, but it's already aware that this feeling is stupid.
Yeah,
that this feeling is a little bit absurd.
Satire version of this, I think.
But Fight Club Fight Club is such a histrionic satire.
But what I mean is not from where they come from, but from the public embracing of it is kind of what I'm
talking
about.
Well, but I guess but I guess what I'm saying is it's having watched it now, everything you're saying is basically true. It does fit into this category. Mm-hmm. But I watch it now and I'm like, what were people so into, if that's what they were into? If they were into it for the feeling of articulated rebellion or anger or angst or whatever.
I'm not even sure people were in the Fight Club for that reason. I don't know that people parse it this way, man.
Well, but you say that, I mean, I don't know that this is true, but if Office Space is still on dorm room walls, why?
That's a great question. And I've seen it around. That poster gets traction. People recognize it. I don't know. I really don't know. And that's what I've been thinking about, is not where did it come from or why did they make it or why did they shoot it the way they're doing it. I accept everything you're saying about that. I don't think you're wrong about that. I do think the reason why it stuck around and hit a nerve is, yeah, it's really funny. Yeah, the characters are memorable. Yeah, there's like, you know, I would have challenged anyone to come up with the plot of this film. I knew there was a heist involving microtransactions, but that's about it.
I remembered it very well, funnily enough. And, you know, I know now it's coming back to me. In our intro, we did talk about the fact that Mike Judge bases his comedy around plots, which I think is funny. And it is true, even though they're tiny little things. The reason that I wouldn't call this a skit film is because there's always some thing progressing the story forward. Mm-hmm. By the way, before I forget this, Joey Devine has been very upset with us lately because
there's no dicks in Office Space, I promise.
Well, they're secret. That's why plenty of dicks. And I think this is applicable here. He gets mad at us when we are like, why'd this movie last? Why'd this movie last? And he is like screaming at his car radio or whatever because of cable TV. He says they played this shit all the time. And Office Space certainly falls into that category. They played this fucking movie on Comedy Central.
But is that a chicken or the egg situation?
It may be. But it has. If there is a poster still on a college kid's wall, it's because they played this on Comedy Central.
Well, that begs the question in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, it found its footing on video. I mean, like, people found it after the theatrical and however
they
found it.
And that's why it plays on television, I would
say. Yes, yes. But it's not. That still has a relationship to why it still is present.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not dismissing the point. I think it's fair. I know it sounds like I'm being a jerk.
I forget what else he was saying this
but I do think
like we were missing the boat.
It found its footing prior to it being run, and it ran because people liked it, and it resonated.
Yeah,
that's why it keeps running. They're making money off of it, and people liked it. And so, it was a really enjoyable rewatch. This movie is
fun
to watch.
Oh, I adored it. I'm not mad that it's still a hit. I just I'm curious. If people are looking at it as a reflection or you know, like it captures this moment of corporate unease.
I don't think anyone is. And this is me thinking about it. I don't think this is. And in fact, if you talk to people about Fight Club, yeah, there's a little bit of a corporate anarchy idea, much more so in the movie than in the book. But that's a movie and a book about masculinity, right? So I'm not saying that.
And so is this. Can I tell you one thing that really struck me for the first time watching this movie? I don't mean to, like, I'm just going to go on to another topic, basically, but maybe this ties in, is that I was watching it and thinking, it struck me for the first time, and I did look it up because I was like, is this true? I'm older than all of them. I'm older than every character in this movie. And that is really crazy because it doesn't feel like it reflects the everyday reality of my life in terms of people who are my age.
This is kind of what you're way in the ballpark of what I'm talking about, which is where people were in their late 20s. These people have now become the political ruling class. This is your, you know, 40, 50, 60 year olds, right? The people who are watching this movie and they're younger and sort of responding to it. There's something about this that I think presages the current political climate. And I don't think it's a crazy leap to make that suggestion. I think there's something here there's a rumbling of dissatisfaction that all these movies are talking about. And one is satire and one is histrionic satire, sure. And one is saying, you know, these drug addicts are more alive than you corporate drones are. You know, there's all these ideas floating around at the time that something's broken. And things in America were fine. Reagan, great. People do fine. HW, whatever. We got a couple wars, things going on. Clinton, but things at the end of Clinton start to kind of fall apart. And then we get George W. And then we get 9/11, right? There's something here right pre 9/11 in the culture that is starting to talk about things aren't right, even though there's nothing we can point to that's wrong. It doesn't feel right. And then all of a sudden we get the bogeyman of you know, Islamic terrorism, and we get 9/11, and we just take a 90-degree turn into something else as a culture that we worry about. But this idea that things are functional, that capitalism is functional, and everyone's like, whoa, something's not right here. We don't feel good.
Well, I hear you, and that the culture started to fracture and look for answers and voices, specifically look for people to articulate it.
Well, meaning in a political sphere. For people to tell them that your life has value and meaning, and here's how you find it.
Or somebody to say it isn't fair, and here's why, and give them a cause to rally around.
Yes, which I think is a similar thing.
Sure, it comes from the same root. Yeah, that's very interesting. So so who are these guys? You know, 20 years on, like, do you think that let's just talk about Office Space, these characters, these guys who are by far the most average of the casts of these three films that we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
Are they politically involved?
Well, I think they go one of two ways. And this is the two ways I think it goes. The culture schisms into people who tune out of politics. I think who are like, the system doesn't, I don't like the system. And this is part of the system is the political system and the office system and the corporate culture. I don't like it. Or I think they turn into people in my family, which is a little bit of radicalized Fox News watchers who search for meaning and find it and say, you know what? It doesn't work. And here's why it doesn't work. I've been told why it doesn't work. These answers make sense to me. And they become sort of mildly radicalized. And they don't go out and do shit, but they just believe.
And the other thing that struck me about them being my age and them being young, I mean, basically I think of all these characters as basically 30 to 35, maybe. And it's that their bosses are still here. Like the Gary Coles and the elder generation in this 20 years later or 18 years later are still there. They haven't gone anywhere. They're still holding upper management positions or presidential positions or whatever. Like, these three guys don't feel like the kind of people who escalate, even though this movie is about the gag of promotion. But by then he's decided to drop out completely and join some other sort of workforce, you know, construction workforce. So I'm interested, when I ask that question, I'm sort of like, I'm really sort of curious, like, what happens in Office Space 20 years later, where they still have some version of these jobs, or maybe they've done startups or whatever, like maybe that's where they wind up. But they are not bosses. I don't see these guys becoming bosses, and maybe that's part of what you mean.
Yeah, that is kind of what I mean, is that this is also around when Sacha Baron Cohen was just using a cultural age divide as the source of all of his comedy. You know, this is the same era. Comedy is built around, oh, old people don't get what I'm saying, and we can mock them without them knowing.
Right.
Great, cool. You know, but there's something about this that for the Gary Cole level, the upper management in the film, the system they came out of is a different system than the main characters coming out of.
Totally.
And it worked for them, and they don't care any more than the lowerlings do. The underlings, but it worked for them. So fuck.
That's where they got, and now that's where they are. So it's fine. So that's it.
You know, and if you haven't come out on top when the whole thing starts to crumble and fall apart, then what do you just stick it out, or do you, like, you know? It's this idea that no one finds meaning in their job in this film. That's part of the comedy. Gary Cole doesn't find meaning. It's just where he shows up and does it.
I love that. I mean, they have this theme and this running gag in the movie, which, again, in a very Mike Judge sort of way, is presented and then peters out, but in a real way. Like, it's not that these, when we say peters out, it's not that these gags they stop working or that they are abandoned. It's that there was nothing really there anyway.
And you're never frustrated by
it. No, and the movie is very tricky that way, where it's like, you know, generally watching movies, you expect something, like, let's just go back to this hypnosis thing. You expect that hypnosis thing to come to a boil. He's either going to snap, or, you know, it's going to have some larger impact on his life, or, you know, who knows? And it just kind of fades away. And another thing that is like that is that, what was I just going to talk about? What were you just talking about? I was
building upper management schisming with the kids, and no one's satisfied.
Oh, yeah. This idea, this thing in the movie where they say that when they were kids, Ron Livingston says, when we were kids, our teacher said, if you had $1 million, what would you do? Yeah. And he said, other people would say, like, well, I would, you know, be with the animals. He said, okay, well, that means that you should grow up to be a veterinarian or whatever those corollaries are. And he says he could never think of an answer. Mm-hmm. And so he is now in a position where he still doesn't have a good answer for what he'd do if he suddenly had $1 million, except that he wants to do nothing. He doesn't want to do anything. And he's like, and when he presents this basic scenario to his, to these, restructuring guys, these consultants, he says, you know, it's not that I'm lazy. You know, I don't mind the idea of working. I just, there's just no reason to do it. I have no investment or motivation to do it. And it does feel like he's talking more about more than just his life. He doesn't particularly care to live a life.
Yeah.
Doesn't really have anything to look forward to or do.
But we have to acknowledge that this is the same wellspring. And this is the identical scene in Fight Club, only it's one played for serious and one played for laughs, which is, I have your ID. If you're not, what's the dream job you never pursued or too scared? If you're not doing that by next year, I have your address, I'll come kill you, whatever, right? That's the serious version of this joke version, but it's pulling from the same idea, which Absolutely. Is we don't know what the fuck to do.
Yeah.
We're a culture who does not know what the
well,
fuck
and
to
these
do
guys are, what are these guys, are these guys just post Generation X or just pre-Generation X, or are they squarely in
they're
the middle?
Square, yeah.
They're square Generation X. Okay. Yeah. So that's, so yeah, you're right. I mean, that they even named it something, because the slacker generation, they didn't know where to put themselves or how to progress the world or how to invest in the world. And they were sort of torn in too many directions without committing to any of it.
Yeah. I mean, listeners, if you haven't read Douglas Copeland, I mean, this is exactly what we're talking about. Generation X is this. It's these characters doing these things.
Right.
It's played a little bit as a comedy, but in a Douglas Copeland sort of like lackadaisical Canadian way. But I was interested at the time, and I remain interested in this time period, because it didn't get to run its course. 9/11 chopped this movement off at the fucking head. And it didn't get to turn into what it was going to turn into. This is a general cultural malaise that did not bear fruit. And because it stopped in its tracks, we'll never know what this was going to become. And there's a reason that you know, the great pieces of art last, but a lot of this doesn't feel relevant anymore because it just went away.
That's one of the most interesting things I've ever heard in my entire life. The idea that this generation was totally stopped from evolving. And it's 100% true. It strikes me as deeply true, because when I was thinking, when I was asking who are these guys 20 years later, I was also rolling around in my head, like, do these guys become Bernie bros? Not really.
No.
They're too old.
Yeah.
And that generation is quite a bit younger in general. And so that's so crazy, because they don't even get that. They don't even get to invest in that, in the new wave of, you know, populism or these two warring forms of populism. They're beyond that too. So what is happening?
Well,
where is Generation X right
well,
now? Like,
look,
what's going on with these people?
Look, there's a situation where, so I have friends who, I won't name names, but they're constantly having crises so they don't have to confront the reality of their lives. And when all of your dishes are done and your house is clean and you don't owe anyone money and your relationships are fine, you have to look at yourself and say, who do I want to be? I have 5 hours of free time here. What am I going to do with it? Am I going to make something? Am I going to go take a lesson? Am I going to go running? Who do I want to be when everything is fine? And this is the late 90s. Things are fine.
Yeah,
who
right.
the fuck do I want to be? And the best thing that can happen to my friends during that time is the water main breaks. And they're like, I got to take care of this water main. I got to thump something I have to do.
Right.
And it prevents them from having to ask the self-reflexive questions that are the real questions of life. And I think what happened as a culture here is that we were starting to get to the point of like, okay, how do we do this now? We have some healthcare bills that didn't quite pass. How do we live best? How do we raise our people out of poverty? How do we become a, you know, a global superpower that is just and wise and whatever? And what are we doing wrong? And complex questions start to arise. 9/11 shits on that, right? And it's a water main breaking. And it gives us something to do. And I would argue we're still in that. We're still in this like post-reactionary
idea. Yeah, perhaps. Gives us something to do, I guess. But it also just led to a totally different set of things to invest in. And I guess that's what you mean. But
yeah.
But what I'm thinking now is it radicalized people who were never part of that cultural conversation and brought them into it in a way that the culture is still reeling from. I mean, and
yes.
By that, I mean radical right.
Yeah. I think that that's one of the reactions to the late 90s is the radical right, is there was a bit of an ideological power vacuum. And strong ideologies right. come in and fill that. And if you come in with people searching for meaning and give them a meaning, then great. That's a recipe for success.
Or just tell people you count now. You've been, you know, even if they didn't feel this way, to say you've been left out.
Yeah.
And now you count.
And that's Fight Club.
Yeah.
It's the whole plot. It's you guys have, you know, you're a generation of men raised by women and the culture has left
well,
behind.
Well, sure, and... sure. But I mean in terms of the radical right, which is that those people were ready to party.
Like... I think you can draw a straight line from Fight Club to the radical right.
Mm.
I mean, I think a lot of, I mean, I think they don't understand the book, but I really think that there is a fond affection of certain alt-right members for that book and that idea.
Well, I mean, that's true that, you know, one of the people who comes right out of the Slacker generation, so much so that he's in Slacker, is fucking, what's his name? Megyn Kelly is just interviewed?
Alex Jones.
Alex Jones.
Yeah.
He's in Slacker and he's in, well, or maybe he's in, I guess he's in Waking Life and Scanner, but he comes from Austin and was a presence when Linklater was building those movies. And Linklater, who's sort of the voice of Generation X, or at least one of the early Generation X, is kind of one of those libertarian dudes who doesn't necessarily commit, in a good way, who doesn't commit to one sort of ideology or not. And he was uncomfortably shoulder to shoulder with Alex Jones, just in the sense of that feeling. Mm-hmm. And you see that when you say that that left an opening, you can see how one goes one way and the other goes way crazy.
It's a schism moment for sure. I remain extraordinarily interested in this time. And I know we got a little away from Office Space, but this is what I've been thinking about all week, is that I was coming right out of grad school. This is like the literary movement that I was really interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Huge transgressive. Late 90s is just fucking shitty narrators doing shitty things. And it's a pushback against the stuff that's going on. And again, the whole literary world changes after 2001 too. You can't publish those things anymore. It's really nasty. It doesn't make sense.
It just doesn't make sense. I would say more so it doesn't make sense. Yeah. Suddenly there's no that's not a conversation to have. Yeah. It's just not.
It's the wrong time and the wrong place. Yeah. Doesn't resonate. And it'll be a long time before it gets back to that.
It may never get back to that. It may never get back to that feeling of, I mean, that took decades
to settle. I agree with you. But you know, and I know Office Space is a weird springboard for this conversation, but it was what I was thinking about, because it is so much closer to Trainspotting and Fight Club than I would have imagined it to be, in terms of, again, not in terms of construction or ideology or purpose. I don't think Mike Judge set out to do this. I'm not making that argument.
No, but he's from the same place. He's literally from Texas. You know, it's so funny that this sort of Slacker thing comes from this place, which, to look at this movie, and one of the things that I actually, this is going to sound odd, but one of the things I love most about it is that it feels... It like, you know, the movie that it reminded me of, this is so weird, but it reminded me of Primer, because it looks like Primer, where it's like, this is a place you actually never see movies, which is like weird strip malls with Chili's restaurants and like Fuddruckers and stuff. And this horrible middle American suburbia where these office buildings live.
Terrifying and banality.
It's so banal. Yeah. And their apartments are so funny, but they're so sickening. Like the places, the environments that these people live in are sickening to me, because there's this the same kind of Venetian blind, you know, bad Venetian blinds, blank walls,
you know, what
average
is?
Couch.
It's the stench of reality that we got with Blair Witch Project, which is, if you actually immerse yourself in the reality of it, you get to real jokes. And the idea that his neighbor can hear through the wall everything that's happening in his apartment, that's based out of reality. Mike Judge went through that, or had a friend who went through
that. And that's why he thinks, I think that he is such a unique artist, because he, everything that he does, like if you just like looked at the jokes on paper or something, they feel, or the characterizations, they feel cartoony and broad, but he never, even Beavis and Butthead, we said this about, he doesn't shoot it that way. And so something, and his main characters are not really, I mean, Beavis and Butthead being the primary exception, are not really that broad. They're pretty human.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of a world that's a little bit crazy, very oppressive, kind of hideous, but American, is just, I don't know another artist who does it. Nobody else mixes things together that way.
Mm-hmm.
And his art is so potent while never seeming to be very flashy. I just think he's a real treasure, and this movie is a classic to me on that level, because it there's no reason that this movie shouldn't inspire that conversation or those ideas, because it's totally in there whether he wants it to be or not. He's just reflecting something, and he knows if you get to the truth of it, it will resonate.
If there's a pull of stuff in a culture at any one time, the best artists are the ones who pull it out and talk about it. And I think that there's no mistaking that all the stuff that's lingered from this time period, or a lot of it, has to do with this underlying issue.
And he's just someone, like, this is a comedy of someone who feels things correctly. Like, he doesn't, what I love about him is this is a silly thing to say, but he doesn't over intellectualize things. He dials that back to a point where the obvious joke to Mike Judge is the correct joke, because that is the truest joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is something that people can spin out of, or very, very quickly overthink. But it makes his work very, very powerful and long lasting.
Yeah, it is crazy that there's incredible, you recognize reality in this film all over the place, and the characterizations are broad, but they're real. The jokes are real. And I mean, part of that is he got great cast. The cast is really, really spectacular in this film, I think. The couple, mild exceptions, I think, but they're really great, and it feels broad and doesn't feel broad simultaneously.
Right,
feels real,
and exactly, it feels real in a way that they don't have ambitions beyond what a normal human being would have, a normal American person would have. They don't want to go anywhere. They aren't thinking of getting to a better city. They don't have dreams of entertainment jobs or of fame, nothing like that. Like, which the one thing that I think makes this in some ways, to me, more powerful almost than Fight Club, at least as a film, is that movie is so obsessed with, you know, fame and broader culture and impact, and it has a lot to do with movies and with sort of mass scale violence, and those ideas don't enter into the heads of these characters. It's not anywhere near their world. And I really like that, because the smallness of it feels more universal in a way, but also it takes out of the conversation the outliers of New York and LA, you know, the two coasts. This is really a middle American film, but it isn't conservative necessarily. It's just reality.
Well, and it's not trying to say something. Fight Club's trying to say a thing so hard, right? And this is not trying to say something. It's trying to mine comedy out of a nice real environment. But that to me is what makes it a precisely great sister film to these other films, because it's coming, I think, from the same set of ingredients in a way, but it takes the opposite choice at every turn. It's a comedy. It's small. It's banal.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's micro. It's realistic.
Down to every detail. I mean, he knows what real details are hilarious, and we'll wrap it up now. But like, let's talk about the movie just for a couple of little things that I thought were so amazing. There's a shot. I know you'll remember this, where they're walking back from the restaurant. And they have to get back to their office building, and they have to go through this grass ditch. And he shoots it in a way where it's like, what is this stupid grass ditch doing here?
Yeah.
But they're completely numb to the experience of having to go down this little valley and then back up this other side.
Right.
And he holds it for that whole shot. And it's, you almost don't even realize how funny it is until you're kind of into it a little bit. Like, at least, I mean, when I saw it.
No, I'm with you 100%.
And like, it's just packed with that stuff of these things that are just only because nobody else would think to shoot it. Is it as funny as it is?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's truth. I mean, it's someone who knows it, and you can't make those things up. It's truth. It feels real because you go, oh yeah, I know.
Well,
that.
And that must have been a place that was actually there. And he's like, we have to include this because this is exactly right. Like, this is so, so dumb that, and it's so believable that this is how they would reaccess their office building. I'm sure there's another way, but this is how they do it.
He does walk that line of just getting these hyper real characters into these environments, and then the comedy doesn't necessarily always even come from their extravagance. It's just really unique talent. It's a very, very specific talent he has that I'm a fan of.
All right, well, go watch it, of course.
Office Space is good.
Office Space is great.
We've had a couple Facebook posts. I don't know if you've seen them.
Oh, no.
Yeah,
what's up?
Someone was I'm sorry I can't pull your name right now, but I will say it next podcast. But we had a listener who was terrified Office Space was going to suck. And he said he's mainly here for the Garner beef, but but he's not even sure Garner beef could save the podcast if we decided Office Space sucks.
Well, did we talk about somebody who was... Did we already talk about the people who were jumping down our throats about saying Spaceballs sucks?
Yeah, we talked about
we
it.
We talked about it?
Yeah, people were upset about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry. We're trying... I don't want to be hurting feelings
no,
here.
No, we're here to be real with you. You came for the realness, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, the real truth. The real truth is that Office Space is amazing.
Office Space is really good. Probably more than you even think, even though you think it's probably pretty funny. It's really good and valuable.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, fuck you, listeners. Yeah. It's better than you even think.
You don't even know.
You got it wrong again.
You don't even know the deal.
I don't know. I have no idea whose turn it is to pull a film, but I'm just going to do it right here.
I think you should do it. It's been a while. I think JC pulled the last one, right? He pulled Office Space.
We didn't pull one for Lexi. He pulled the last... It's all... We're way behind, but we're back to the normal format. Here we go. The next movie we're going to watch, Travis.
Yes, sir.
Oh, fuck you. Oh, my God.
Is it Footloose?
This is going to be a rough ride.
Oh, is it Goonies?
This applies to the conversation we were just having, but it's going to be rough. Rough, folks. Next week on Does Your Favorite Movie Suck, find out if The Boondock Saints sucks.
Well, we're right in the fucking era here. I'm ready to get into this.
This is going to be so interesting to talk about.
Yeah, I'm ready for this. Let's just do it right now. Okay, bye. We'll see you in a second.